So now it is time to get into the subject, and for the next couple of sessions we're going to speak about differential equations. What are differential equations? Well, there's many examples you could give, and we'll be dealing with only part of the entire class of differential equations you could formulate. A good example of what we're not going to talk about is the ordinary differential equation. What could be said about ordinary differential equations is that they can generally be written in terms of first order equations with one variable or with several coupled variables. An example is the equation of motion, the Newton equation, which can be written in terms of a time derivative of the velocity being proportional to the acceleration, and the position being the time derivative of the position being proportional to the velocity. Such equations, ordinary differential equations, are generally quite simple to integrate unless the problem is stiff. That means if two spatial scales are very separate from each other. And then you need to take care of the stiffness in a special manner. But we're not going to deal with these kind of problems. We will focus on partial differential equations. And partial differential equations generally involve at least two variables. It could be two variables of space, or variable in time, and one spatial variable at least. So if there's two spatial variables, or even more of them, you generally call this type of problem a boundary value problem. You want to solve the differential equation knowing what are the values of the boundary. On the other hand, if you have an initial value problem, then you try to propagate the information in time. And these differential equations, these initial value problems, will depend clearly on an initial condition you have to specify at the very beginning of the integration. Now, what type of boundary conditions can you find? You can find, for example, Dirichlet type of boundary conditions. And as an example, I could give a pressure wave. When I'm speaking to you, I create a pressure wave, and this pressure wave propagates to the wall, for example. Now, this pressure perturbation cannot move the wall. The tiny mass of air cannot move this very heavy wall. And therefore, you have to impose that the perturbation is fixed at the wall. That's typically a Dirichlet boundary condition. Another boundary condition you could impose is the so-called von Neumann boundary condition, where the derivative is imposed. What could I give as an example is the propagation of heat. Imagine a rod in which you propagate a heat pulse. If this rod is very well isolated from an external medium, the temperature at the surface of this rod is essentially given by the amount of heat which reaches the edge of this conductor or of this rod. The only thing you can specify is that the heat is not lost because you have a very good insulator. And therefore, if the heat is not lost, then the temperature gradient has to remain small. That's typically a von Neumann boundary condition. Now there is examples which mix the Dirichlet and von Neumann boundary conditions, and these are usually called Robin boundary conditions. There, for an example which is a bit more complicated, you could take the electric field or the electromagnetic field at the surface of a conductor. If this conductor is partially resistive, that means it's not a perfect conductor, then the electric field can have a tangential component so that the magnetic field lines for example, can have a certain angle with respect to the surface with respect to this conductor. Third type of boundary condition is the periodic one. What the example I could give there is a crystal. Take a crystal and you're interested in solving for the wave function in this crystal. A crystal is a periodic arrangement of atoms, and therefore you can approximate this crystal as an infinite amount of periodic cells in which you want to solve your differential equation. A last example I want to give you for boundary conditions is the outgoing waves. And there it's as simple as open the door in the room and the pressure wave will simply leave the room and never come back. That's the outgoing wave boundary condition you will have to deal with in exercises. Now, partial differential equations can be, so to say, classified in general terms by analyzing their characteristics. And this you can do by taking partial derivative with respect to space and then write all the other terms remaining in terms of differentials with respect to time. And then you form a quadratic equation, which you can solve with a regular quadratic formula, which is written in your text. Now you know that depending on the sign of the discriminant, you will have very different solutions. If the discriminant is negative, then the partial differential equation is called elliptic. And that's typically what happens with the Laplace equation. If the discriminant is exactly zero, then the differential equation is called parabolic, and that's what happens for the heat equation. And finally, if the discriminant is positive, then you have two characteristics, which happens when you have wave equations, and represents the two directions you can propagate the wave. A wave equation has always two solutions, one propagating in one direction and the other one the other way. So that's the three types of characteristics or the three types of differential equations you can have, either no characteristic, one characteristic, or two characteristics. A final thing I would like to say as an introduction to these differential equations is that very often we're going to use moments, which are integrations of phase space. So we formulate a phase space integral and use this in terms of a conservation quantity. For example, if you simulate a domain density as a function of time, you may be able to say that you don't lose any particle or any density of your domain for which you solve your differential equation. Numerically, this may not be as trivial to guarantee, and therefore to calculate total density may yield a very useful test of your numerical discretization, a self-consistency check. So that's the type of calculations we generally do to guarantee that we're calculating something reasonable. If you take moments of order zero, generally speaking, you calculate density. Or if you calculate moments of order one, you talk about momentum. Or orders of, if you go to second order, then generally speaking, you're dealing with an energy. Let's go over to prototype problems. Now, before we try to understand what type of numerics we have to deal with to solve differential equations, let me give examples of what type of problems we can solve and what type of generic behavior we have to deal with. Now, why are we interested first in differential equations? Because they provide for a very powerful description of a global problem in terms of infinitesimal changes locally. So if we know the change very locally, somewhere in the medium, we can, by using the differential calculus, solve for the entire domain without having to deal with the entire domain when we deal with the modeling or the trying to formulate the equations of your system. So that's why differential equations are so powerful. We can formulate differential changes locally and obtain global solutions. An example is the advection. Advection is sometimes called convection and simply represents the motion of something, of a fluid. An example of an advection is, for example, a dye, drop of dye falling into a river. If you have this river flowing at a constant speed, this drop of dye will be carried away by the river, and you could follow it very quickly. The speed of this dye particles will be exactly the same in average as the flow of the river. That's an example of advection. Another one, which is useful particularly in Sweden in winter, is the radiator. What is the principle of a radiator? You have a rod of iron which is heated up, heats up the air, and light air starts to move upwards. So you have a streaming of air in your room, and this streaming carries the energy from the radiator finally to you. So it's a convection or an advection. Now, the advection equation, you see, is given by the balance between a time derivative term and a spatial derivative, a first order spatial derivative. And the constant in front of the spatial derivative is the so-called convection or advection speed. So now I suggest in your web browser, you should have opened next to you, try to open the applet where you have a preset convection problem. Using a Lagrangian scheme we will introduce later, let's now try to see how Gaussian propagates under constant convection or advection speed. Press start. You see now that your pulse propagates forward at the constant speed, moves forward exactly in a similar manner as I was telling for the drop of dye in a river. That's the first type of problem we want to analyze and try to resolve numerically. That's the advection problem. Now, before I go over to another prototype problem, I would like simply to highlight the fact that a wave equation can be written in terms of two coupled advection equations. We will not use that immediately, but it will reappear later in the course when we will solve leapfrog schemes. And you can understand this. A wave equation has two characteristics, always two waves propagating forward and backward. So if you're able to combine these two advections together into one single equation, all what you get is the wave equation. That's the simple understanding of the phenomenon. Okay, let me go over to a second prototype problem, and that's dealing with diffusion. Diffusion generally is the result of a random motion at the microscopic scale. So you will have a very nice exercise dealing with the random walk of many different particles and trying to follow these many different particles moving with a Brownian motion, you immediately see that you obtain a diffusion process. Now, if you analyze diffusion with a fluid equation, you see that you have essentially to balance a time derivative with a second order derivative in space. And the coefficient which dictates the proportionality between both terms is the so-called diffusion coefficient. Now, you can solve the diffusion equation analytically, and this is done here in terms of a Green's function. I let you read specialized literature to find out how you can calculate the solution of the Green's function, or alternatively you can carry out the exercise which aims exactly at this using the Laplace transform. But now let me show illustrate with the applet in your web browser what diffusion corresponds to if you do a numerical calculation. So let us start with a square pulse which has very sharp edges, and now press start to see how this square box propagates in time. You see how it immediately smears away, gets very round in shape, and here moves forward. So that's the result between a strong diffusion, which eats away the sharp edges, and an advection, as we saw just before, which carries the pulse forward. So here you have the analog computed of a drop of dye which falls into the water, which flows very, very slowly. So what will happen? Your dye, when it falls into the water, first has a very strong concentration. You will be able to see it very well in the water and will advance. But very quickly, this sharp transition between transparent and, say, blue water will disappear and smear out, and your dye will start to diffuse. That's the analog, the physical analog, if you want, of what you just saw in the computation. You should, in your applets now, try to understand how different scale lengths get affected in a different manner by the diffusion process. So I let you choose a cosine function to start with your calculation, and will let you try out different wavelengths to see after 10 steps of a given period, if you want, try to find out how much you smear out your initial pulse. And you will find out that short wavelengths get scaled away much quicker than long wavelengths. And this can be understood in terms of a so-called dispersion relation, which is written here as a relation between the frequency and the wavelength. And you see that this frequency, or the rate of decay, since it's an imaginary frequency, is proportional to the square of the wave vector, or the inverse square of the wavelength. So short wavelengths get damped away much more quickly. Try to reproduce this in your applet. Third prototype problem we'll be analyzing in this course is the phenomenon of dispersion. There, it's more difficult to give an example, but maybe some of you have listened to shortwave radio. And if you listen to shortwave radio stations, you sometimes hear this sweeping noise, which starts at very high frequency and goes down and down and down in frequency. So-called Whistler type of waves. So where are they from? I can tell you they stem from thunderstorms. They stem from thunderstorms, for example, in the South Pole, which create a very large spectrum of waves, so to say white noise. Now, this white noise, white electromagnetic noise, has a tendency to follow the magnetic field line of the Earth. And the magnetic field line of the Earth will carry the information from the South Pole back to the North, and you will be listening to the result of this thunder at the very other end of the Earth. Fair enough. What happens then is that short or high frequency perturbations propagate faster than low frequency perturbations. And instead of getting this bang of the thunder, you now get the same information, but dispersed in time. First the short, or rather the high frequencies, and then later the low frequencies. That's an example of dispersion. And here it's written in terms of a proportionality between the phase velocity and the wave vector. We'll see an example later on how you do calculation with dispersion. Now, an important topic is the nonlinearities you can get in differential equations. And one example is the so-called wave breaking. What is wave breaking? I hope everybody of you has experienced it at the seashore. That's exactly what the terminology says. It's the breaking of waves. You have waves arriving from the sea, and suddenly they move up and start to break on you. That's what is fun when you're doing surfing. So that's a phenomenon which can be understood in terms of an advection term. If you look at the wave breaking equation, it looks like an advection equation, except that the advection velocity now is given by the amplitude of the perturbation. So large amplitude perturbations propagate faster than the low amplitude perturbations. Now, if you do simulate this equation with a numerical scheme, you will immediately run into troubles, because the function you calculate with will suddenly start to be multiple valued. Clearly, a wave breaking, you have the top of the wave falling on you. So you will have, so to say, different solutions for your perturbation for one single spatial coordinate. So we have to balance this wave breaking with some kind of other phenomenon to keep the solution single valued. One such balance we can form is to balance the wave breaking with the diffusion. And that's what's so-called the Burger equation, or generally speaking, the shockwave equation. The shockwaves you create as well with, if you travel at supersonic speed with an airplane, then you get the so-called supersonic bang. That's a very sharp pulse or a sharp perturbation of the pressure, which propagates away from the airplane to the person who hears it. This you can simulate now in your web browser, going to the applet and executing a simulation with the Burger equation. You start off a Gaussian pulse, and if you press now the start button, you see a sharp front developing, which then smears out more and more as you propagate forward in time. So the diffusion, so to say, removed the very sharp shock front. And I let you play a little bit, changing the value of the diffusion coefficient, and you will see that if you get to very low diffusion coefficients, you will develop very sharp shock fronts. And eventually here you will see that you run into a regime where you cannot trust the numerical calculation anymore, and we'll try to understand this in the next chapter. If I balance the wave breaking term Now with dispersion instead of diffusion, then I get another type of generic equation, which is called the Korteweg-de-Vries equation, KdV, which generally has solitons as solutions. Now, solitary waves have been discovered in the past century by a famous physicist who was on a horse observing what happened to perturbations in a water channel. And he observed that, so to say, water perturbations were propagating extremely far and remained, so to say, in the same shape, were simply translating in space. This you can simulate by pressing start now in your applet, and you see two pulses propagating at different speeds. That's the result of dispersion. Short wavelengths here propagate faster than long wavelengths, and you create the collision, which you see in your screen, between long wavelength and low amplitude pulses which propagate slowly, and high amplitude short wavelength pulses which propagate more rapidly. That's solitons, which are the analog of this water perturbations which had been observed in the channel in the last century. Before we try to find out how we can solve different partial differential equations, we now need to look into how we can represent in a digital manner a certain signal. There is many ways to carry the information forward in time by taking small time steps. So we can divide the information in slices of time and find links between these different slices of time. We can also split up the spatial dimensions into digital information, so evolve a set of numbers which will represent your function. Now, which method is best to do that is really opened and depends on specific problems, on the specific problem you want to solve. You have basically only to satisfy one condition, that is, when you increase the spatial resolution, if you take more and more information into account, both in space and time, you want the numerical solution which you compute to converge to the analytical or real solution. That's the only real condition you need to satisfy, the condition of convergence. Now, what will dictate the choice of this discretization can be, for example, the structure of the differential equation. You may want to guarantee a certain continuity, regularity. You may have to do post-processing, filtering, implement diagnostics. You may have to implement difficult boundary conditions at the edge of your simulation domain. Or the differential operators may be very time-consuming to implement, or you may not have the memory to do that easily with every method. So the real choice is open to you, is up to you to decide. And this course is a lot about giving you the tools to make the right decision. So we don't want to give you one unique recipe to solve your problem, but rather give you many different ways you can carry out your integration of the differential equation in the most appropriate manner. So, first way to simply represent a signal is a simple sampling of the signal either in space or time. That's what's done in your CD when you listen to music. what has been done is the sound from the microphone has been sampled in time and simply reproduces the signal in a digital manner in a time sequence. That's what you see also in your figure, how first long wavelength oscillation is sampled in space, and you see as the wavelength gets shorter and shorter, how the sampling finally doesn't reproduce the signal anymore, so that you lose the significance of the sampling. Note that in such a sampled manner, you never know really what was the information between two sampled mesh points. You can do an interpolation later on to find out, but formally, the solution is unknown almost everywhere except at those sampled mesh points. And also the derivative is not known unless you measure this derivative as well. Now it's probably useful, since we're talking about derivatives and sample values, to introduce the Taylor expansion and show you how you can write the value of the function at a certain position in terms of a neighboring one. And if you write Taylor expansions and combine them, you can find out manners to calculate the spatial derivatives, as it is done in the notes, by taking small differences between adjacent positions and dividing by the spatial separation, the distance between the evaluation of these quantities. That's the so-called finite differencing. And you can formulate derivatives or finite differences either to the left or to the right, as it is done in the notes, or as an alternative, which then you find out is more precise from the Taylor expansion, you can calculate this derivative in a centered manner, which is an evaluation which generally is more precise and has an error of the order of the separation of the mesh points to the square. So that's a first way to do discretization. The second way is the so-called finite element approach. And this may be easier to understand for physicists who are familiar with Hilbert spaces. The approach essentially consists in superposing finite elements, which means functions which range over a finite spatial scale, typically only over two neighboring, over one neighboring mesh point, that means ranging to the nearest neighbor to the right and the nearest neighbor to the left. If you do such a superposition of hat functions, for example, if they're linear functions as in the course, you can calculate a weight for each of this finite element. For example, if you take the same function again we discretized before with finite differencing and do a finite element discretization, you will see that the finite element number 5 has a weight which has to be of minus 0.95 or 947 to be precise to reproduce exactly the value of the function we want to sample. So we calculate from the original function a series of weights which are attributed to each of these rooftop functions or hat functions. What is the advantage here? Well, first of all, the advantage is that we know the solution everywhere. Since we calculate only weights for different functions, these superpositions are defined everywhere the underlying functions are defined on. And therefore, we have a continuous representation now of the function. Second advantage, which will appear later, is that we can, with finite elements, easily densify the mesh. That means take an irregular structure, a sampling which gets more and more spaced in the regions we are particularly interested in. So that's a considerable advantage, which is usually significant for finite elements. Note that you can use also higher order polynomials to do finite element decompositions. You can use quadratic or cubic polynomials, and then simply you have to write the superposition of this cubic polynomials in terms of two coefficients at the same time, the value and the derivative of the function if you do a certain choice, at least, of this decomposition. Third way to do discretization is with so-called splines. And there again, the idea is you take a high-order polynomial, here a cubic function, and try to approximate an initial sampling of the function you want to discretize. Now, if you want to require that the function is smooth, you can write, for example, the cubic function in terms of values and second derivatives, and you compute the coefficients from the functions A, B, C, and D, which are defined in your notes. From these, you can calculate what the first derivative is and what the second derivative is. Now, usually, these second derivatives are calculated instead of measured, and they can be calculated by requiring that the first order derivative is continuous. So you get an extra condition which results in a tri-diagonal system you have to solve. And if you do this, then your cubic spline interpolation will appear as it is in the figure. So you start with the sampled values, and with only these sampled values, you form now a very high quality approximation which defines also the derivative everywhere on your function very precisely. Now I have a question to all of you. We saw already different ways to approximate function, and I asked you the question, do the sampled values used with the sampling correspond in some manner to the coefficients calculated for the finite elements? And do these coefficients have anything to do with the values used for the cubic spline interpolation? I let you figure out. Now let me go on with another approach. So far we've seen local ways to approximate your solution. You want to represent a certain signal by a very local approximation on a mesh point. That's what we've done so far. Another way of doing things, especially if you have periodic domains, is to decompose a signal into periodic functions, harmonic functions. Imagine, for example, the 440 Hz on the telephone. If you would like to make a recording of this telephone, it's much cheaper to simply tell you it's 440 Hz and create an oscillator which oscillates at this frequency. You don't need to sample this oscillation to a high degree of accuracy. That's typically the idea behind harmonic function decompositions. So the what is generally used is the discrete Fourier transform, which I hope everybody's familiar with, and if not, you need to open a mathematics textbook to learn about it. What we're using with computers is essentially this discrete Fourier transform implemented in a very efficient manner. Instead of calculating of the order of 8m square operations, we can do a trick to reduce the number of operations to m log 2m operations. And this is using the so-called fast Fourier transform, which we can do if the value of m is a power, an integer power of 2. I let you read in your notes how this is exactly carried out. And it's only another way of calculating the standard discrete Fourier transform. What happens with Fourier transforms in general is that very short wavelengths will result in the so-called Gibbs phenomenon. And the figure in your text illustrates this with a square function, which is approximated either with 3, 6, or 12 harmonic functions. And you see how I increase the number of functions, I get a higher and higher resolution, a better and better representation of this square periodic function. However, the overshoot at the very edge of these boxes always remains. That's the so-called Gibbs phenomenon. And there is no way to get rid of it unless you take an infinite amount of harmonic functions and superpose them. So you will always have to deal with this Gibbs phenomenon if you have very sharp transitions. That's for global ways of representing functions. We've seen local ways, global ways. Now, one interesting manner is to use wavelets, and that's an idea in between. Having an initial approximation of your data, of your function, you would like to be able to get additional information, making it more precise. So you'd like to have first a general idea and add corrections to this general idea and until you get to the refinement you would like to have. This is illustrated with the so-called Haar wavelets. Haar wavelet at level 4, Haar wavelet representation of the same function we've been using so far, is given in your figure, and it is shown that by adding a correction term, which is called W4 here, you can take the Haar wavelet at level 4 representation up to a higher degree of refinement at level 5, which has a better description of the initial approximation. You should, after all, be very familiar with that, because if you watch your web browser and open digital pictures, you would generally see first a blurred image which gets more and more refined. That's in fact the wavelet transform, which first gives you a very approximate description of this picture, which gets more and more precise as more data comes in to form the picture. Now, one problem with the Haar wavelets, which is of particular concern to us, is that we cannot easily calculate derivatives with box functions. And therefore, they're not used for differential equations, but rather for integral equations. Now, another way of formulating a wavelet transform has been proposed by Mrs. Daubertjes, who realized that there is a linear transformation which has a cost of order n operations, and which allows you to calculate wavelet transform in a particular manner. I let you read in the manuscript how this is algorithmically implemented, but on the picture you see again how the initial function we've been approximating gets more and more refined as you go from fourth level approximation using Dauberchi wavelets to the fifth level by adding a correction term of order W4. So by adding this correction term, you get a better representation. Now you may ask, your function looks extremely discontinuous, and it is. There is lots of places where the derivative is not defined. So can I represent the polynomial? Well, actually you can. The different cusps of the wavelets cancel out exactly so that you can recover a polynomial approximation with a certain number of wavelets. It's just a matter of going to high order enough. So now we've seen local ways to approximate data in a digital manner using a mesh, finite element decomposition, or splines, or global manners where we superposed harmonic functions or wavelet functions. Let us now look into an entirely different way of approximating digital signals, and that's using quasi-particles. And that's a great opportunity for me to introduce Johan Hedin, who has been assisting me in this course ever since we started, and who's actively doing research using quasi-particles. So, welcome, Johan.
Thank you, Andrea. Good luck. Hello. I will talk about quasi-particle approximation, it's fundamentally different from fluid approximations. And now, if the physics is particles or a fluid distribution function, that's really a philosophical question, and it really depends on the problem. So you can do either or. You can approximate real particle situation with the fluid distribution, and you can approximate the fluid distribution with pseudo particles, as we will see later on. So if we look at the first equation, you will see that f, which is the function, now is the sum of particles. And this you can imagine, you know, like people in an elevator. You have different weight, which is W, and you have S, which is the shape of the people, from the person in the elevator. And now, just to make it simpler, we'll drop the weight, so we will have a cartoon situation where everyone is exactly the same, it's simpler to draw. So everyone will have the same weight, and we'll have F is the sum of the shapes. Now, to make it even simpler, in the rest of the course, we will use a Dirac function for the shape. We have point-like particles. And as you will read in the lecture notes, there is certain ways to plot this particle distribution, because it's often hard to plot. You have to plot a bunch of particles and try to get some density spectrum, for example. So what we use is a projection. And something you should note and be careful about is that you should use the same projection as you're doing the plotting, which you will see in a figure. Otherwise, you could get misleading results. And this is what I'm going to say about particles right now. We'll come back afterwards in the Monte Carlo section. And you should also look at the web browser and see an applet, and you see what you see in blue is the ideal function. In black, you will see the representation, which is the projection of the particles, which are blue red. So what you should do is press initialize a few times, just get a graph of how good is 100 particles simulating a box function. Having said that, I will turn back to André, and he'll tell you about the exercises.
Thank you very much, Johan. You will see him later in this course when we'll be talking about Monte Carlo manners of discretizing partial differential equations. Now, before we finish in this introduction section, let me just point out a couple of exercises I would like you to carry out and alternatively simply read in the corrections. The first one is dealing with the publishing of your results in a digital manner. We will be in contact with each other, even though you may be thousands of kilometers away from the location where I correct them. So you have to try to find out the efficient manner to carry out your assignments and bring them over to us so that we can correct them and feedback on you. This is the topic of exercise 1.2. We would like you to carry out in particular. A very nice exercise is also the one dealing with a random walk. And this will show you in a very much physical manner how you can connect Brownian motion of particles, Johan has just been talking about, with the so-called diffusion process. If you go now on your web page to the random walk solution, you can very easily make a simulation of a Brownian motion with one particle and then change the number of particles to a high number. And by comparison, you will see that the random motion of a large amount of particles, if you superpose this and calculate the density, corresponds, in fact, to a diffusion process. So that's a very nice exercise you can already do now without knowing all the Monte Carlo formalism. So for the time being, I'll let you carry out the exercises and come back into the next section in a little while. Thank you for your attention.